September the 11th taught us that terrorists will try to use the openness of our country against us. We must understand and correct our vulnerabilities. We need to know who's coming in and who's going out of our country.
After 9/11, President George W. Bush and his administration decided the United States needed to secure its borders in the interest of national security. So on February 28, 2003, President Bush announced an overhaul of the nation's security infrastructure to employees of the newly created Department of Homeland Security.
March 1st marks an important day for our government and for our country. The work ahead won't always be easy. You've accepted a difficult mission. But I'm confident in the success of our efforts because I'm confident in you.
One new and important addition was an agency called Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which would come to be known as ICE. Back in 2003, the agency had a budget of just $3.3 billion in its first year of operation. But by 2013, ICE's budget had nearly doubled to almost $6 billion. The United States was spending more on immigration enforcement than all other federal criminal law enforcement agencies, including the FBI and the DEA combined. Today, the agency has become the focus of one of the most contentious debates in the country. And depending on who you ask, its employees are dangerous agents of the state or federal employees who are doing the job they've been asked to do. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we look at the department at the center of the immigration debate in the United States. John Amaya was the deputy chief of staff for ICE from 2015 to 2017, and Alonzo Pena was the deputy director of ICE from 2008 to 2010 and had worked with the agency since its inception. Alonzo takes us through how ICE began to change under the Obama administration.
As soon as Obama came in and John Morton came in as the director and I as the deputy, one of the things we looked at was to reform the detention centers and how people were being detained, what service were being provided to them, providing, you know, secure, safe, and humane detention for the people that were going to be coming into detention. And then also there was a big focus under the Obama administration and under Director Morton to prioritize, you know, the resources that we were given. And the top priorities were going to be threats to national security, threats to public safety, people with gang, you know, affiliation, leaning toward committing violent acts, and then anybody that we felt that posed a threat to the community, we were going to work with state and local law enforcement agencies to go after those people that we felt were the greatest threats.
John, you were the deputy chief of staff for ICE from 2015 to 2017. Tell us a little bit about your experience when you joined the agency.
Sure. So at the time that I joined the agency, the president and then Secretary Johnson had moved to implement an executive action and really narrowly focus the priorities of the agency to ensure that, consistent with what Alonzo was just saying, that the agency is focused on national security threats, on criminal threats to society, and of course, recent border entries. I was charged as the designated federal officer in overseeing an advisory review of family detention as it existed at that time.
There's a lot of reporting and a lot of sort of back and forth among you know, a lot of our audience about what happened under the Obama administration and what didn't happen. And just so we're clear with our listeners, family separation was not a part of the Obama administration's policies. Is that correct?
The separation of families was absolutely not happening. It was something that was discussed internally, which I can assure you that even in the most securest facilities where these discussions were being taken place, ICE strenuously at the time opposed even pursuing families for arrest once they had been released because of the optics and what it would do, not just to the families who were going to be ripped apart, but also the psyche of the agents who were going to have to do this job and physically remove children from the arms of their mothers. We were not doing that.
And I want to get back to the psyche of the agents in just a minute, but I will say, and I'm sure you both are aware, that the Obama administration was roundly criticized for its enforcement, if you will, of immigration practices. So many folks are saying that it essentially laid the groundwork
for the current administration to escalate these practices. Do either of you have a response to that?
Let me make a couple of comments on that.
And sure.
It's going to maybe dovetail on something that that John just spoke about. There was two big programs that were instituted, and those two programs initially were programs that were supposed to identify, as we talked earlier, as John and I both have said, you know, a prioritization of who our targets were going to be. That's the way it was supposed to come out. But unfortunately, I think we had some problems in the field having people follow those directions, because at the end of the day, you got human nature coming into play, and a stat for some people is a stat, whether, you know, you put a gang member and you put him in a removal proceeding, or whether you put somebody who just got stopped because they had a broken taillight. And I think that's one of the things that resulted in why Obama got the title of deporter in chief, because we were using these programs that were designed and initially came out that we were going to use them to attack the threats. And unfortunately, some in the field, they didn't operate under the guidelines that we were giving them.
John, your reaction to that?
Sure. I think Alonzo is on point in terms of the intent of the program. And the other issue that I will add is that the other problem when it came to some of this outsourcing or these relationships that we had with local jurisdictions is that oftentimes, you know, the individuals' jurisdictions that would enter into these programs were politically driven. And when you identify some of these folks that include the likes of Joe Arpaio in Arizona, and you know everyone knows his background and his troubles, but you also have other sheriffs who, for better or for worse, there were county sheriffs in Illinois, one in particular who was trying to cross-reference Puerto Rican-born U.S. citizens to ICE. And I think, you know, the criticism was fair, as Alonzo said. President Obama once, you know, as a government, we were deporting over 400,000 people a year, you know, got the title of deporter in chief.
And John, I want to sort of go back to your comment about trauma, because I think that it's important for our listeners to understand who and how that trauma is created. You mentioned some of the ICE agents were traumatized or could potentially feel traumatized because of their jobs. I just want to make sure I'm clear.
Yeah, I mean, I think listeners probably would be less sympathetic to the officers and more sympathetic to the mothers and the babies, which I think is appropriate. But I just want to make clear that I heard multiple times an officer or an agent tell me, we did not sign up for this. We did not sign up to put car seats in the back of our vehicles. We did not sign up to arrest mommies and babies. They signed up to protect the nation. And by arresting the most vulnerable in society, that's not exactly doing that.
Alonzo, what is your take on what you're seeing in the past couple of weeks?
Well, to me, it's very disturbing that we have gotten to the point that we would institute a policy like that, that anybody who crosses the border, that which is for whatever reason, to not use, you know, discretion, prosecutorial discretion. It's just a sad commentary that this whole issue has become so political that we're willing to do that. That we had an administration that was willing to take those steps and actually implement that policy, knowing that it was the possibility that there'd be this collateral issue of separating children from their parents. It's just very, very disturbing to me that we would have an administration that would go forward with such a policy.
I'd echo what Alonzo said, and I would just add that, you know, I'm personally offended and disgusted by what I'm seeing, because I never imagined that we would be in a scenario where the President of the United States and the Attorney General of the United States, the highest ranking law enforcement official in this country, would make the types of comments that they make on the air that were typically reserved for the most extreme voices on television and radio, to include labeling an entire demographic as invaders, as criminals. And yet that's where we are today. And this is how and why they've been able to get to the point where they are. They dehumanize an entire population to ensure that, I don't know, maybe they can sleep better at night, but certainly so that way they can justify the policies that they're putting into place, and then quickly laugh off this idea that, you know, they really didn't want to do this, but the laws that were put in place by the past administration forced them to do so, which any person with an average IQ understands that is a complete farce. They put themselves into this position. They created the crises that they found themselves in. We had a real crisis in 2014 when we had large numbers of unaccompanied children and families coming across the border. That was a real humanitarian crisis. What we're seeing right now is something that was self-induced. It was a political crisis of their own creation.
Are either of you in touch with people who are currently working within ICE? And if so, I wonder if you could share with us a little bit about the feelings that those folks are having.
I can say for Alonzo, the vast majority of the people that I've talked to are very dismayed and very disheartened by this zero tolerance policy and the separation of that's resulting in the separation of children from their parents. But there's a few who are hardliners who say, well, they're just enforcing the law. The laws have been on the books, and you know they're finally getting to do their job. That's a minority.
So, in both of your expertise and experience, what, if anything, can be done?
When it comes to the agents that actually have to do their job, I just say it's very difficult for an agent who is trying to put, you know, finish a career, have a career, do the right thing every day, make the right decisions when the leadership, when it's coming from the very top, seeing them defend these policies with lies or misstatements or falses, whatever you want to call them, and have those agents want to do their job every day, and knowing their job is so difficult, but it just gets complicated when the leadership is going to defend these policies the way they are.
John, did you want to add anything to that? Or
sure. I think when officers and agents are just a handful of years away from retirement, and they've seen what can be done to some of the highest ranking officials within the FBI in such a public way, to be your garden variety line officer or line agent, it's a place of solitude. It's a very lonely place to be when you're trying to protect yourself and ensure that you can provide for your family, and you only have a handful of years left to ensure that you complete your 20 years or your mandatory and are able to ensure those benefits are passed on to your family.
And I appreciate you both answering those questions, although I'm sure there will be listeners who, as you mentioned earlier, John, would say, well, you know, who cares about the officers? What about the families? And I think that's it's a tough question and conversation to have. But I do appreciate both of your answers, your willingness to talk to us. Alonzo Pena was the deputy director of ICE from 2008 to 2010, and John Amaya was the deputy chief of staff for ICE from 2015 to 2017. Alonzo and John, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure.
We've been here 5 days now. It's morning on the fifth day, holding down the space in front of the loading docks where vans are taken out to deport people.
Set the children free! No. Set the children free! Set the children free! Set the children free!
This weekend, some protesters set up camps at ICE facilities across the country, calling for an end to human rights abuses by the Trump administration against immigrants. In other parts of the country, protesters stopped buses filled with migrant children leaving from one detention center to another, like here in McAllen, Texas.
Listen, guys, I know you guys are all being peaceful, okay? But you guys cannot be obstructing the roadway.
We are peaceful. We are peaceful.
Everybody cannot be on the roadway.
Omar Suleiman helped lead one of the protests that stopped the buses. He's the founder and president of the Yakin Institute for Islamic Research and co-chair of Faith Forward Dallas.
When the protests had started, we actually saw this bus come out, and one of the pastors who was part of our delegation from Faith Forward Dallas, Pastor Rachel Bachman, she tells me that there are children in that bus. And we both look really closely and we go up to it. And at that point, someone else is on the megaphone. And so I scream out to the man that was on the megaphone, and I tell him that there are children in the bus. And so people start saying that. And then we sort of rush the street. So before that, we were across the street and we rushed the street, and some sat in front of the bus. Some started to bang on the bus. Some started to put their hands on the bus in prayer. I mean, so it was a heightened emotional state. Some people just broke down crying because immediately when we got up close to the bus and you look up, you just see a bunch of crying children. And these children are so lost, and it's soundproof glass. So some of the people are shouting out in Spanish certain things to them. But I mean, they can't hear anything because we couldn't hear them. And clearly some of them were screaming. And so at that point, because some people had sat in front of the bus, and I guess the police were not ready for this, nor were the agents. I think it was pretty silly of them to think they could literally, you know, get a bus out right next to the protest.
Did they end up getting the bus out? I mean, from what I saw, there were lots of protests, but then ultimately the protesters were moved aside and the buses did ultimately go where they were planning on going, correct?
Well, we had about 20 minutes. That's where I put, you know, the photos, you know, of me with my hand on the bus came out. And so, I mean, that's where, you know, I just put my hand on the bus and started praying with some of the children, putting my hand up to their hand and making eye contact with them and, you know, just praying with them. And then at that point, the police had come and they sort of separated, you know, formed a wall between the bus and the protesters up front. And then they pulled me off the bus or, you know, away from the bus, I should say. And just reversed it out. And they either took a back road at that point or they pulled it right back into the detention facility. We weren't prepared for, and when I say we, I mean collectively as a group, I don't think that there was an action of civil disobedience that was pre-planned. And so because civil disobedience wasn't planned, unfortunately, the cops just sort of pulled us out and moved the bus out.
And last week on the show, I spoke about a similar issue with a Southern Baptist minister from Montgomery, Alabama, a conservative, who said they were also part of a coalition of religious leaders speaking out against family separation policies. Tell us a little bit about what your religious teachings as an Islamic scholar tell us about how we should understand this moment.
God tells us in the Quran that we have honored the child of Adam. And I think that one of the things that's happening is that these children are not just being separated from their parents, but they're being separated from their human family. When you have Fox News anchors that say, well, it's not like these are our children from Texas or Omaha or whatever it is. These are our children. These are human beings. These are children that are just as precious as any blue-eyed, blonde-haired child in Texas or on the northern border. And so from a religious perspective, if God has honored and dignified these children, then we too should be called to honor and dignify these children as our own. And I say this particularly to the evangelical community and to those that are watching their text, their biblical scriptures being used to justify these horrific actions. Welcome to my world as a Muslim leader. You know, when I constantly have some guy in Iraq, right, that's using my text to perpetuate horrific actions. Well, guess what? We have people in our government that are using religious text to perpetuate horrific actions. And so this is not Christian terror, just like what Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and ISIS do is not Islamic terror. This is just terror. And religion should be part of the solution. We should be using our scriptures to uplift the most vulnerable and the oppressed, not to subjugate them further. And not to oppress them further. And the evangelical community needs to step up because I live, you know, only a few miles away from Robert Jeffress, who has sanctioned some of the most disgusting and ungodly actions that I have ever seen in my entire life. And so I think that the religious community as a whole needs to stand together and to uplift people in the name of God.
Omar Suleiman is founder and president of the Yaqeen Institute for Islamic Research. Omar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we've been exploring the immigration debate these past few weeks, we've been hearing from you.
Hi, it's Marion in Southern Pines, North Carolina. It really is a human trafficking issue. It's Trump's version of human trafficking. And I just can't get the image out of my mind of the little five-year-old boy silently sitting there, but tears streaming down his cheeks, and the fact that these children are so silent and not showing any emotion.
Hi, this is Howard. I'm calling from New York City. So maybe a lot of people believe that we shouldn't have illegal immigrants coming into the country. Maybe a lot of people believe that if you're coming illegally, you should be arrested and detained. Maybe a lot of people now to see his words become action will more vote for him.
Hi, I'm coming from Orlando, Florida. One, is really hard because a lot of immigrants that come to this country are working 12 to 18 hours per day. And I don't really think the white community will accept Hispanics because they learn English. Racist people are always going to be racist no matter what.
And what do you think about the crisis in the border or other things we're seeing happening in Congress this week? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Hey, thanks for checking out the Takeaways podcast. I know there are like hundreds of podcasts out there, so we really appreciate you choosing ours. And if you like what you hear, why not help spread the word? You leaving us a rating or a review on iTunes will definitely help us stand out from the pack. Thanks in advance.
Turkish voters handed President Tayyip Erdogan a decisive victory this weekend, extending his 16-year grip on power. Erdogan has already consolidated executive power during his tenure as president. Sunday's election gives him even more power over the judiciary and legislature. Critics say Turkey is at risk of becoming an authoritarian state. In the lead-up to the election, 19 international freedom of expression organizations sent a joint letter to Erdogan demanding the release of jailed journalists and a restoration of an impartial judiciary. Aslide Intashbash is a journalist in Istanbul and a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and she joins me now. Asla, welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
So the sense on the ground among Turkish voters today is what? We saw Erdogan with a 52% win, correct?
Yes, and it's higher than expectations. The feeling among pollsters must be not so good this morning because they've nearly all failed. But I have to say, AKP supporters have celebrated on the streets last night, Erdogan's supporters. But the other half of the country, meaning the non-52%, the 48%, is suffering from a bit of a heartbreak. I think the opposition campaign was very energized. The opposition was united for the first time in 16 years of Erdogan reign. And I think that there was the expectation that this would go for a runoff, that he wouldn't attain the 51% necessary to renew his mandate. That did not happen. It was a decisive victory last night. And, you know, maybe it's a bit of a heartbreak on the opposition camp this morning.
Now, tell us a little bit about how this election was conducted. Was this considered a fair election?
The atmosphere going into the elections was certainly not fair in the sense that you had one politician in jail, only able to pass on messages via Twitter or social media as relayed by his lawyers. And then the main opposition party, CHP, had a new candidate who managed to attain 31% within less than 2 months. But many of his rallies were not broadcast. In fact, nearly all of President Erdogan's speeches and all his speeches are broadcast on all networks on television, but not the opposition. So that's only one of the many examples of the government's control over media. Other problems were going into the elections. I think both the opposition and the incumbent party was really keen on protecting the ballots. So you had ballot observers in some places, tension in parts of the country. You have to see Turks watching their ballots. I actually took part in the ballot counting in my own district and where I voted. We had 18 people in the room counting, all political parties and some citizens. And that was across the country, in some cases leading to very tense moments. You could see that as people taking matters into their own hands and democracy at play. But you could also see that as a sign of the deep polarization and distrust in Turkish society.
Now, does this give Erdogan a mandate? I mean, we've already known he's been in power for nearly two decades now. This was a democratic election. Does he feel at this point he has a mandate? And is there really a future without Erdogan at this point?
Long term is unknown. I can't answer that. But clearly, he now has a mandate to rule. He will also be ruling under an entirely new system because we had a referendum last year, which similarly passed with 51% of the vote. He will have an executive presidency consolidating nearly all power in his own hands. But he will also have to deal with an economic downturn, a very serious one. And he will also be beholden to his coalition partners, ultranationalists, both in parliament and in terms of governing the country. So, yes, he is almighty and all-powerful, but he still has to deal with a split country and he still has to rely on ultranationalists in order to be able to govern.
Aslı Aydın Taşbaş is a journalist in Istanbul and a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Aslı, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
I see mothers bury their sons. I want my mom to never feel that pain. I am confused and afraid. Those words were part of a poem written by 15-year-old Antoine Rose II. Last week, Rose was pulled over by police around 8:40 p.m. He and another person fled. He was unarmed. A police officer shot him three times in the back, killing him.
Why are they shooting? All they did was run, and they're shooting at them.
Police say they were investigating a drive-by shooting, and Rose's car matched a witness description of the vehicle. Since the shooting, there have been protests in Pittsburgh, with protesters shutting down a highway this weekend and people demanding answers from authorities. Chris Potter is with us, and he's the government and accountability editor with Pittsburgh's public radio station, WESA, and he's been at these protests. Chris, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
Some of our listeners may not have followed this as quickly as we have and as closely as we have. Can you give us a sense for what the reaction has been on the ground? We heard a little bit about these protests, but what's the overall case that people are looking at?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a reporter in this town for 25 years, and I have never seen protests like I have seen since Tuesday when Antoine Rose was shot and killed. There have been four successive nights of protests. They have lasted for hours. They have taken place in different areas all around the city. The most recent one was on Saturday night, and the protesters were in what's sort of euphemistically called an entertainment district, the south side of Pittsburgh, which is largely sort of a bar area where you see a lot of bros and bachelorettes on a usual Saturday night. They have gone everywhere. They have been disruptive. The protests have. They have stopped traffic. The Parkway East, which is the highway you referred to, is a major artery. It was blocked up for miles and for 4 or 5 hours on Thursday evening. They have been very disruptive. They have also been peaceful, very, very much so, as a matter of fact.
Can you give us a sense of who the officer is that's at the center of this as well?
Well, we don't know a heck of a lot at this point. He has spoken only to one reporter to a local TV station. His name is Michael Rosfeld. He had been working in East Pittsburgh Borough, which is the community where this all happened, only for a few weeks. Prior to that, he had worked for a couple of other suburban police departments and for the police department at the University of Pittsburgh, which is located within the city itself. He left the University of Pittsburgh. There was reporting in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette that he had arrested a few students at that university, including the son of a high-ranking administration official at the school. And when it was time to press charges, the DA's office basically found that what was in his report, his police report, was not supported by the evidence. He left shortly thereafter. He had served in a couple of other suburban departments and then just recently started at the East Pittsburgh Borough Police.
Tell us a little bit about the protesters themselves. What are they calling for? The resignation of this officer? Are they a diverse group themselves? Who is protesting?
Yeah, this is a very young group. It's a racially diverse group, black and white. A lot of them are new to protests, the ones that I've spoken to, but are very upset because this is not the first incident of this kind of its kind here in Pittsburgh. There have been multiple shootings under murky circumstances. What they're asking for is for the officer to be prosecuted. A lot of their focus is on our district attorney, Stephen Zappala, who they blame he's been in office for about 20 years, and there have been calls previously for him to be more aggressive about prosecuting these cases. So there is a push for charges to be filed against the officer and also a threat that if that doesn't happen, Mr. Zappala is up for a re-election next year, and we'll see where that gets him.
Chris Potter, WESA, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show for today. Did you miss anything? Find it all on thetakeaway.org. I recommend a special episode we put out this weekend with all of the stories from our masculinity series last week.
You know, us as men, we have to start doing our work and developing ourselves. I don't think we ever really process our experience. And so there's a lot of baggage that I believe everybody is carrying with them.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.